Good evening. From Rhode Island Public Radio and the Rhode Island Public Health Institute, it's a special hour on one of the greatest public health challenges of our time. We're talking about an infectious disease that affects millions of Americans, thousands of Rhode Islanders among them. Hepatitis C has been called the silent killer because most people don't know they have it. It attacks the liver slowly, quietly over decades, and left untreated, it can lead to cirrhosis, liver cancer, and even death. But there's hope. Brand new drugs have just hit the market that can cure hepatitis C. The trouble is, they are so expensive, nobody knows how we're going to pay for them all. Our guests tonight have some answers. They're going to help us dive into this dilemma and explore some solutions. So I'm your host, Kristen Gourlay. We are broadcasting in front of a live audience here on the campus of Brown University. Stay with us. So hepatitis C isn't always easy to talk about, right? It's partly because of how you get exposed to this disease. There's a lot of stigma surrounding this. And you get exposed mainly from injecting drugs and sharing needles or drug paraphernalia. And Hep C is incredibly infectious. It takes contact with only a microscopic amount of blood to get exposed. And here in Rhode Island and throughout many parts of the nation, we've got really something of a perfect storm brewing, I think. More and more young people are getting hooked on prescription painkillers, opioids, and then turning to heroin, injecting heroin, and that's putting them at risk of hepatitis C. So that happens to be part of Jonathan Goyer's story, but there's so much more to his story than that, of course, and I'd like to welcome him here tonight. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you.
So, Jonathan, let's just start off with a big one. You are in recovery from addiction.
I am.
19 months, is it?
19 months.
Congratulations. Yeah. That's awesome. That is not easy. So let's just jump right into it. You also have been diagnosed with hepatitis C.
I have,
so
yes.
Tell us, how did you get hepatitis C? What happened?
Well, at the age of... As a young teenager, I began using drugs intranasally, and that just quickly progressed into IV drug use. By the age of 18, I was an IV drug user, and I was sharing needles with people. And if you don't mind, I'll tell you the one-minute version of the story.
Yes.
of how I was diagnosed with hepatitis C. I had a using buddy that I was using with. And we scored some heroin, and we only had one needle. And I was so sick, going through physical withdrawals, the physical opiate withdrawal, that knowing full well that he had hepatitis C, it didn't matter to me. I needed that shot of heroin to the point where I knew the risk involved, and it just didn't matter to me.
Mm-hmm. You're really brave to be here tonight. I just want to say that and to share your story.
Not everybody's story here.
I have to say, though, it strikes me, so many people, I talk to a lot of people who have chronic hepatitis C in my reporting on this series I did called At the Crossroads, and so many people said to me, I knew the person I was sharing a needle with had hepatitis C, but I was so sick, it didn't matter. And for people who haven't been addicted, aren't familiar with addiction, it's probably a little hard to understand, but it gets to that point where you're so desperate, you'll do anything.
If you're living under a bridge shooting heroin, you probably don't care that much about your health.
Fair enough. So I'm curious about the reaction of your family and friends to your diagnosis. Have you faced any stigma, any reactions you want to share?
I haven't really. My family's been very supportive of me and supportive of my recovery, understanding that that's going to happen first before any other medical issue
right.
is addressed.
So no stigma. That's
not from friends or family.
Yeah, but
generally, yeah, I suppose you could say that. Not everybody's too very fond of IV drug using. People on the street living under bridges and prostituting themselves and whatever else they're doing to make money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you are getting the medical care you need now, which is great. But you haven't had your hepatitis C treated yet. Can you talk about why that is?
So, having gotten to recovery, and by the way, I just want to mention, linking somebody to care, and I'm a hepatitis C test counselor nowadays also.
Pretty amazing.
Linking somebody to care, the biggest barrier in doing that is if they're a substance abuse.
Right.
A substance user, nothing can be addressed until that is addressed first, in my experience. Once I got into recovery and stabilized in my recovery, I decided to inquire about, hey, I should probably get this treated. But most importantly, getting into recovery, I stopped the risky behavior. The risky behaviors I was engaging in that put me at risk in the first place. And once I stabilized in recovery, I sought treatment. Mm-hmm. Now, having been somebody that was unemployed living on the streets, I didn't exactly have Blue Cross insurance. Mm. So I signed up for Medicaid. And as I began to inquire about treatment, I noticed that there was a lot of testing that I had to do, blood work and biopsies and ultrasounds. But that's when I hit the barrier of, hey, there's these great new drugs, but your insurance won't cover them.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit, those treatment options. But first, I just also want to mention, you know, you've come so far since those moments, you know, under a bridge, sharing needles. You are literally the face or one of the faces of a new campaign, a media campaign in the state of Rhode Island, promoting recovery. Addiction is a disease, recovery is possible.
Yes.
And which is incredible. And that's really brave. And I just wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about your life now.
Oh boy. It's much more entertaining if you want the past version of my story, no? So basically, I found recovery, through other friends that were in recovery, and just they almost just addressed it as a sort of a harm reduction issue of just being loving and empathetic towards me and compassionate, never shutting the door on me, and just being there and loving me until I was willing to love myself. Mm. And that's the thing that you see with a lot of these people. If you're doing at-risk behaviors, you clearly don't love yourself. So I think it's really up to us as a community to love them until they can.
And you mentioned you're also now a hepatitis C testing counselor. Can
Yes.
you talk a little bit about your work?
So I work for a nonprofit organization called Project Weber, funded by Department of Health. It is a nonprofit that is funded to test and link to care a targeted population of at-risk men on the streets of Providence. And I'll just tell you briefly, last year I've tested 150 people, 14 of those were HIV positive, almost 50 were Hep C positive. And these are people that are primarily living on the streets, and probably about 60% of them are IV drug users.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So we'll get back to some of that in a little bit. I'd like to introduce the person sitting next to you who happens to be, we've talked about this, it's okay to say, your doctor as well,
okay.
Dr. Thomas Seepy. Welcome, Dr. Seepy.
Thank you.
So you're a liver specialist here in Providence, you're a gastroenterologist, and you treat patients, some of whom have hepatitis C. And I'm just wondering if you could tell us, are you seeing more patients like Jonathan today than you were, I don't know, say five years ago or so?
I think we're seeing a large number of more patients now with the amazing revolution in antiviral therapy in the last year. You know, we have a long history and a long experience with patients like Jonathan who have histories with substance abuse and have really turned their lives around and have made it into therapy and have been cured by antiviral therapy. Right now, the amount of work that's presenting to our liver center is quite frankly overwhelming, because the word is out. And if the word hasn't been out, hopefully it's going to be out further this evening.
The word that we have new treatments, we can cure.
We have new treatments. Just very briefly, the history of antiviral therapy is really a long one and a disappointing one. 20 years ago, we were giving people interferon shots three times a week with about a 5% chance for cure. Now, treating people is really simple. The drug regimens that we have had developed at our center and are coming into clinical practice all have cure rates well over 95%. And more importantly, the side effect profile is essentially none. And, you know, for those of us who've been treating really thousands of patients over a 25-year career, it's been an evolution, but we've had a lot of treatment delivered. We've cured many patients over the years, but the morbidity has been really staggering.
And when you say morbidity, you mean
side effects. Interferon therapy, the cornerstone of old treatment, very, very difficult to undertake. Ribavirin, its cousin, is soon to leave. Very problematic, very difficult. The newer treatments, just to give perspective, there are two that are now approved, but one that was approved in October called Harvoni. Our experience with it is about 70 in the trial space, and we have right now close to 70 people on Harvoni, and no one's having side effects. It's unbelievable. So it's a great time. It's what should be the most exciting time of my career. And I think as we're going to address for the remainder of the hour, there are many frustrations that are preventing us from really being able to share that with all of our patients.
You mentioned that patients are just coming out of the woodwork. They've heard about the cures available, the new treatments available, and they want to get treatment. What kinds of what manifestations of this disease are you seeing in your clinic? For people who aren't as familiar with what hepatitis C can do to a body, tell us about what you're seeing.
Sure. Well, probably 40% of my practice is a referral base for cirrhotic patients. Our center right now is diagnosing 3 to 4 patients with liver cancer from hepatitis C per month in Providence. And while we've had major improvements in the therapy of hepatoma in the last decade, it's still very problematic. It's still cancer, and it's very costly. So I think we're going to be talking more about costs. I think every dime that we're going to be deploying using these drugs is worth it, because if the average liver transplant costs $650,000, and the average first attempt at hepatoma therapy is almost $250,000, $90,000 doesn't seem so problematic anymore.
And that's the average cost between the two.
Let's just call it 90
newest
for
drugs.
Now. It's higher in some instances.
It's
a little less in some instances. It's a lot of money, but this is a curative therapy. Mm-hmm. This isn't a suppressive therapy. It's a curative therapy.
So these drugs are hugely expensive, as you mentioned. We will be talking about this a little bit more, but I just want to say those numbers one more time so it sinks in. $84,000 is the price of Sovaldi, which is one of the newest drugs out there. And you have to take that, I think, in combination with other drugs sometimes, right? And then Harvoni is another of the newest drugs, and that's $94,000 per course. Although it's one pill a day, right? So that's a huge improvement on what you had before. But, you know, understandably, insurers, payers are being pretty careful about who they approve to take these drugs. What's it been like for you and your staff to try to get people on these medications?
That's a 4-hour teleconference in and of itself. But the reality of it is it's incredible. So my Hep C nurse, who really manages most of our prior approvals, spends anywhere from 15 to 20 hours a week now trying to get prior authorizations.
A prior authorization, by the way, is paperwork you have to fill out before you can get a drug from an insurance company.
Assuming that we can get a drug. So we have medications that might be on formulary. We have restrictions, and I think that's important to understand. Jonathan's story with his insurance in Rhode Island. Rhode Island's part of a Medicaid consortium that has restricted therapy for advanced patients, sicker patients, F3, F4. I support the Medicaid policy. I don't agree with it. All should be treated, but right now we have limited funds and we need to cure the sickest patients first. On the other hand, the conversations we've had in private are really, they're very profound. He has turned his life around. He wants to be cured. He has other aspirations that are best kept in private between us. And I can't treat him at this point. And it's frustrating. It's very frustrating for him, many others. We've had patients crying in the office, yelling at us, yelling at the director of Medicaid. It's been a very amazing 6 months of frustration.
Yeah. You're listening to Hepatitis C, Cost, Cure, and Challenge on Rhode Island Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from Brown University. I want to come back to you, Jonathan Goyer. You know, as you listen to Dr. CB talk about these treatments and the frustrations, you know, your thoughts?
Well, I just want to point out, too, that one treatment that is available is interferon. And it's been available for a while, but I just want to make it a point to tell everyone, if you got hepatitis C, you were probably an IV drug user, such as myself. And the side effects of interferon can be parallel to the side effects of drug withdrawal. So for somebody like me, who's new in recovery, that's not. That's why I got out of the using drugs, because I didn't want to feel those sort of side effects anymore.
Yeah. That's something people don't think about, I think, is that you know, just trying interferon is uncomfortable at the very least for people, but for someone who's new in recovery, it could feel like withdrawal symptoms and be a trigger.
Correct.
Essentially, right?
Correct.
Okay. So insurers, we've just been talking about, are, you know, they're in a bind. You recognize, Dr. CP, that, you know, Medicaid can't afford to treat everybody right now, much as you'd like to, right? And yet, you know, Jonathan is waiting. You have other patients who are waiting. You mentioned they're crying in your office. I mean, this is heartbreaking. What are the human costs of waiting?
Well, the biggest cost would be if that patient decompensates or develops a liver cancer while we wait to get them on treatment.
Can you explain decompensate?
You had mentioned that earlier in the introduction. So two things happen as people get sicker from liver disease. They can develop liver cancer, which we've talked about, and then their liver can just give out and fail. And that would require a liver transplantation to maintain life. And unfortunately, where we live in the Northeast, it's very, most people die on a liver transplant list in New England, then get them, because there aren't enough grafts. So the stakes are very high. There's also a concern that many practitioners have is this artificial F3, F4. You know, it's a continuum, and people can be F2, F3, and they're actually sicker than one would think.
And those are stages of cirrhosis or fibrosis.
These are stages of damage from the liver disease. Mm-hmm. And it's a very slippery slope to be so dogmatic to say we can only treat the very sickest. The one thing we haven't mentioned, too, is we're focusing on the sickest patients from a liver perspective. We also have many patients who have secondary manifestations from Hep C, a growing link to diabetes, something called cryoglobulinemia, arthritis, renal disease, and these people may have very early stage liver disease, and they need to be treated.
Right. So we just have a few seconds here, but Jonathan, as you see more and more people in your outreach work, as a testing counselor, how tough is it to link those people to treatment?
It's nearly impossible. I'll just say very briefly, a lot of the people that I come across, it's what I refer to as a sort of a window of willingness that they may have. And this state does very, very well with HIV, Lincolnshire Care, and services provided. Mm-hmm. But right now, when I test somebody who's not even on the grid or their health insurance is very minimal, there's nothing I can refer them to. Mm-hmm. And that window might disappear, and it may never come back, their window to get a willingness to get into care.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there for now. I'd like to thank Dr. Thomas Seepy and Jonathan Goyer for being up here. We're going to take a quick break. From Rhode Island Public Radio and the Rhode Island Public Health Institute, this is Hepatitis C, Cost, Cure, and Challenge. We are live from the campus of Brown University in Providence. I'm Kristen Gourlay, and joining me now is Dr. Thomas Stopka from Tufts University. He is an epidemiologist who specializes in using geographic information systems to map the spread of disease. Welcome, Dr. Stopka.
Thanks very much, Kristen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So there is evidence that the rising rate of injection drug use in this region, in the country, is fueling a wave of new hepatitis C infections. And I know that researchers are still just getting a handle on this trend, but what do we know about them and about this trend now?
Well, I can speak more definitively about the data in Massachusetts. And recent research showed a 78% increase in hepatitis C reported cases.
78%?
Yeah, 78% amongst 15 to 24-year-olds. Okay, so we're seeing rises, particularly in a younger population in the past decade. Looking more broadly, in a study that looked at multiple states, in population of people who inject drugs under 30 years of age, there's about a 70% increase. And so this trend of increasing rates in younger populations, we're seeing in places in New England, but it's also being witnessed in other places.
It's incredible. And so that's new infections. But also right now, I mean, we can't talk about hepatitis C without talking about the fact that people are dying from this disease right now, and they're dying in greater and greater numbers. I've heard directly from the head of the CDC's viral hepatitis division that some states have seen a 200% increase in deaths just over the past few years. And this is something that you have mapped, at least in Massachusetts. Tell us what you found.
Yes, along with one of my staff and students, David Myers, we looked at hepatitis C and HIV mortality and hepatitis C mortality between 2002 and 2011, we saw about 3,000 cases or 3,000 deaths tied to hepatitis C. Now, that's probably vastly underreported because a lot of people are not diagnosed. And oftentimes, when we do mortality data analyses, we're dependent on the coroner and the contributing cause and underlying cause of death that is reported, on the death certificate. But we are seeing increases in deaths over time. We haven't seen a huge significant increase, but we are seeing an increase in deaths. And I imagine it's only a matter of time. If the treatments aren't applied broadly across populations, that we may continue to see increases.
I wonder if you could zero in on a particular area or one of those hot spots that you found and just talk a little bit more about it. Give us a sense of what's going on, what kind of area you're talking about.
Sure. So we used geographic information systems and spatial epidemiology to look at clusters of hepatitis C deaths across census tracts in Massachusetts. And we found clusters of hepatitis C in South Boston, in Worcester, Springfield, New Bedford, the Merrimack Valley, which is in the Lawrence, Lowell area, as well as a few other areas. And so those are locations where we're seeing elevated clustering of deaths within the past decade attributed to hepatitis C.
What's going on in some of those areas in your estimation?
Well, injection drug use, relatively large populations of people who inject drugs. Some of those areas don't have syringe exchange programs and don't have perhaps adequate prevention programs. So places like Worcester, Springfield, Lawrence, New Bedford, where there are large populations of people who inject drugs, may not have adequate access to prevention programs.
Right. Your research also found that there were some racial disparities in the deaths. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. We found that African-American and Latino mortality rates were higher as it related to hepatitis C, anywhere from 2 to 5 times higher rates of mortality compared to whites.
And these are people who've had chronic hepatitis C, one imagines, for a while, correct?
Yeah, so, and that's an important point. When we look at mortality data, we're looking at people who have died from hepatitis C, but who were likely infected 2 or 3 decades earlier, maybe more in some cases. So it's hard in looking at the mortality data to look directly at their risk factors, where they were when they were infected, and how they progressed. So that's one of the limitations in looking at mortality data. In some of our current research, we're starting to look at prevalence data, so people living with hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that in a moment. Project ahead 10 years, 20 years from now, what are these hotspots likely to look like, or where would you expect to find them on the map?
I mean, my hope is that the costs of hepatitis C treatment will come down in that broad treatment across folks who are infected will help to diminish the prevalence and incidence of disease. You know, in epidemiology, one of our prime goals is decreasing the chance that a susceptible person can come into contact with somebody who's living with the virus. And so if the treatments can be applied broadly, I think, like we've seen with HIV, treatment as prevention can be very powerful. If the cost remains high, and if access to treatment remains challenging for a large swath of the population who's living with hepatitis C, we may see continued clustering. Some of the recent research shows increases in young, white, suburban, and rural populations as well. So that's another concern.
Right, right. And people who use illicit drugs are often going to find themselves involved with the criminal justice system. And that's why we have Dr. Michael Poshkas here. I want to thank you for joining us tonight, Dr. Poshkas.
Thank you for having me.
So you treat inmates in Rhode Island's correctional system, as well as at Thunder Mist Health Center. And I just want you to give us a sense, how prevalent is hepatitis C in Rhode Island's prisons?
Well, as we discussed, hepatitis C mirrors the same population with addiction, and that often brings people into the prison system. And as a result, the prevalence is fairly high in the population. Estimates range from 10 to 30% of the prison population can have hepatitis C at any time. The population is a fluid population and changes, but so we could estimate that there may be 150 to 300 patients, inmates, who currently have hepatitis C in the correctional system in Rhode Island.
And what about nationwide?
The same, the prevalence is continues to be at that point. So nationwide, it's a huge burden on the correctional healthcare system.
Right. And we have, what, about 2 million people within the criminal justice system in care at any one time, and 10 million or so cycling in and out. So that's a huge number if it's up to 30%, 40%.
Right. It is a huge number. And it's also, though, it's a huge opportunity to use that time when the individuals are incarcerated to do screening, to do education regarding transmission, and also to discuss options regarding vaccination to prevent other bloodborne pathogens like hepatitis B. And it's also recommended to vaccinate against hepatitis A and to do screening for HIV. And it's an important opportunity to link people into healthcare. Especially when they get released from prison, which most of the individuals do.
Right. In fact, this, let's talk just a little bit more about this. This idea is gaining some more traction that, you know, we could really make a dent in the overall epidemic if we really focused our efforts on treating and curing inmates right now. What's your opinion? Is that feasible? Set aside the money issue for right now.
But set aside the money issue, I think that would be very feasible and would be an excellent way to start and to hit these hot spots, as we were talking. This is a population that is cycling in and out, that unfortunately they often relapse to addiction after getting released and will continue to spread this infection in the community. So this is a fantastic opportunity to potentially eradicate this infection and to really break this cycle of infection that we're going out into the community with addiction, addressing trying to help with their addiction as they transition to the community, but also it would be an excellent opportunity to break that cycle of hepatitis C if money were not an issue, but unfortunately it is.
It is, and we're going to talk about that some more. You're listening to Hepatitis C, Cost, Cure, and Challenge on Rhode Island Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from Brown University. I'm your host, Kristen Gourlay. And let's continue with you just a little bit, Dr. Poshkas. You know, even though it's theoretically possible to cure most inmates of their chronic hepatitis C now, financially, it looks impossible at this moment. I mean, I'd like to take 2 seconds to put this in perspective. The Rhode Island Department of Corrections pharmaceutical budget, their entire pharmaceutical budget is about $2.5 million. It doesn't take many patients at $84,000, $150,000, $94,000, whatever the course of treatment you're going with, to eat up that entire budget, right? So, but you've got sick patients right now. I was in a clinic with you when you were seeing one of them. How do you manage with this impossible math?
So what we've been doing is we've been trying to track all of the patients who have hepatitis C and are focusing on those who have more advanced disease. We're meeting with them individually, talking about the new treatment options that are available, and then we discuss it at a committee, and we try to match the same community standards. And so currently we're following Medicaid guidelines, sort of limiting it to those patients who have more advanced disease and are offering treatment to them. As we've seen, a lot of the patients have been there for many, many years, and they've failed previous treatments and have suffered
like
the
interferon.
Consequences. Yeah, the pegylated interferon, and had suffered the consequences of the side effects associated with that, and their disease has progressed, and that continues to require often frequent hospitalizations related to that, cirrhosis, the potential for developing liver cancer. So the option of not treating it is quite costly also. Right. So even though it's a large cost up front, we're really trying to, especially for the inmates who have a long sentence, that ultimately we need to address it.
Right. And you have started treating a small number of inmates, as far as I know, right?
Yes.
With these new drugs. And tell me your response to this. There might be some people listening who think, you know, what if these inmates go out and relapse and get reinfected? I mean, is this a good use of taxpayer dollars? Because all of this, all of the money spent on healthcare in the Department of Corrections in Rhode Island is taxpayer money. Is that a good use of taxpayer dollars? How would you answer that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, it is a public health emergency with this hepatitis C, and that the patients, while they're incarcerated, are being covered by state dollars. But often when they get released, they'll be either uninsured or on Medicaid and are still under state dollars and responsibility and important to care for them. And so we continue to look for other options to help pay for this. HIV has been an excellent example for ways to do that with the Ryan White funding. And if there's a way to get increased federal dollars to help support paying for the medications during this opportunity while they're incarcerated, that would be an excellent resource of the dollars. And I think from a public health perspective would be very valuable also, in addition to treating their addiction. So hopefully they don't get reinfected, and the chances of them getting reinfected are very low. But especially if they were to get treatment for addiction after they get released, the chances of getting reinfected are very low, and I think the cost would equal out.
Let's bring you back into the conversation, Thomas Stopka, epidemiologist with Tufts University. So it's so clear from our discussion that hepatitis C and addiction, these two diseases are just intimately linked, and it's hard to know where to focus your efforts, your prevention efforts, even with limited resources. I wonder your thoughts. What more, perhaps, do we need to know in order to intervene at this moment with younger injection drug users, for example?
Yeah, I think that intersection of substance use, misuse, addiction, and disease that you highlighted is an important one. It's challenging for many of our colleagues in harm reduction circles, in syringe exchange programs, in clinical settings, to get treatment on demand. Oftentimes, when somebody in the throes of addiction is ready for drug treatment program, beds are not always available. Inpatient, outpatient slots are not always available. So certainly that's an important part of the equation, is trying to increase access to drug treatment, ideally on demand. Going after the highest risk populations with regard to hepatitis C is important, and that's where I think the work that we do in looking at hepatitis C hotspot clusters could help to guide public health decisions about the locations where intervention, where treatment, where prevention is particularly needed,
right.
And where maybe you'd see the biggest bang for the buck in the short term and long term.
Michael Poshkas, your thoughts on interventions we could be focusing on now from your perspective?
Well, I'm also a primary care doctor in the community, and a fair number of my patients suffer from addiction, and the balance of chronic pain and the overdose, the epidemic of deaths that we're seeing in Rhode Island related to that is really a challenge, and I applaud Dr. Fine and the health department in really tackling the addiction to prescription medications and this balance of and trying to help develop pain medicine regulations for that. So I think as we improve trying to control the prescription of opioid and controlled medications by the providers, that's one thing. And then having increasing the links to substance use treatment centers, such as methadone maintenance programs or inpatient treatment programs, that would be, I think, very valuable to help break this cycle and to help with the treatment of addiction also.
What's next for you in your research? I understand that you'll be looking at prevalence rates now. Can you tell me just briefly what you'll be looking at?
Sure, yeah. I'll be looking at hepatitis C reported cases between 2002 and 2013 in Massachusetts. There were about 90,000 cases that were reported during that time frame across Massachusetts. So we'll look at that information spatially and geographically to try to determine where the hotspots are for prevalent cases. And we're interested to see how the hotspots compare for people living with the virus to those who have passed away from the virus and see whether there are any changes, because we can get at least a little bit closer to when the actual transmission took place with the prevalence data. Ideally, we want to look at incidence data and new cases moving forward as well and how that spreads.
We will follow it because this is something that no one really has a handle on yet, but there's growing evidence that it's going to be a problem. So I want to thank you both, Dr. Michael Poshkas with Thunder Mist Health Center and the Department of Corrections here in Rhode Island, and Dr. Thomas Stopka with Tufts University. We are going to take a very short break right now. You are listening to Rhode Island Public Radio. I'm your host, Kristen Gourlay, and together with the Rhode Island Public Health Institute, we are bringing you Hepatitis C Cost, Cure, and Challenge. We're broadcasting in front of a live audience here on the campus of Brown University, and coming up, we are going to meet a couple of women who are leading the battle against hepatitis C in Rhode Island. Stay with us. From Rhode Island Public Radio and the Rhode Island Public Health Institute, this is Hepatitis C, Cost, Cure, and Challenge. We are broadcasting live on the campus of Brown University. I'm your host, Kristen Gourlay. We are talking about the high cost of hepatitis C in human lives, in suffering, in healthcare dollars. And I am joined now by Dr. Lynn Taylor. Dr. Taylor is an infectious disease specialist with the Miriam Hospital, and she teaches also at Brown University. And she's been helping patients battle hepatitis C and other infectious diseases for many years. And recently, she decided to marshal a really diverse group of people, a group of resources to help in that battle. And she started an organization called RI Defeats Hep C. Dr. Taylor, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us what you're trying to do with RI Defeats Hep C.
So first of all, thank you for the privilege of joining in tonight. And I want to thank John and Letitia Carter and the Rhode Island Foundation for the Rhode Island Innovation Fellowship, Rhode Island Defeats Hep C, and acknowledge my many partners at the Miriam Hospital and Brown University, all the physicians, Dr. Megan Pinkston Camp, Dr. Karen Tashima, Tim Flanagan, many others, our nurse Sheila Tumilty, who I see here, our wonderful community collaborators, Paul Fitzgerald, Ray Joseph, at AIDS Care Ocean State, because it's imperative that any discussion about Hep C is focused on community. And I see Sophie Sprech-Walsh, our nurse at Kodak, and Dr. Pelagian, our methadone program, who are focused on evaluating and caring for Hep C. So I do have to thank all these people. And I see Dr. Brandon Marshall, our epidemiologist, who helped us come up with our estimate of 16,000 individuals infected with Hep C in Rhode Island. And I appreciate what we've discussed tonight, but I do want to reframe this a little bit. I don't want anyone in the audience or listening in to think that the crisis in Rhode Island and the crisis in America is about incident or new hep C infections. That's a problem. And Jonathan, I'm so respectful and appreciative of your story and what you shared. And I see young people with new hep C infections every day. But the crisis is about people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond who are dying right now, calling, crying, dying, while the carrot of curative safe therapy is hanging there. We're talking about double digits of new infections versus tens of thousands of Rhode Islanders who dabbled in injection drugs or intranasal drug use. Remember, this infection can be acquired through snorting cocaine once in the 80s in New York. Maybe you went to Woodstock. Maybe you went to a party in college. We're not talking about primarily people who are currently struggling with injection drug use. This is one or two times years ago, and now we have grandmas and grandpas, breadwinners, caretakers, parents, physicians, judges, people in all kinds of fields who are stuck now with the very high risk of illness, suffering, death that is all could be averted and avoided with access to curative therapy. So please just know we're talking about a baby boomer crisis, people born between 1945 and 1965. That's the urgency.
Okay. Very important to note. And just tell us briefly, what are you trying to do with RI Defeats Hep C? What are some of your main goals?
We really, between our beautiful health department and our public health institute and our public health schools and Dr. Sipi and all the wonderful medical institutions, I see Dr. Alexander, we really are a state, I feel so optimistic, that could be the first to eliminate hepatitis C with a coordinated, proactive effort. And we have many different goals. One is to focus on high-risk populations with on-site integrated care, not trying to take individuals and navigate them through a whole continuum, through locale to locale, from step to step over years and months, but go to places where there's a lot of disease. So that's why I work with Sophie, where Dr. Plegian began the process at Kodak, Rhode Island's nonprofit methadone maintenance program, and we see and care for patients right there and make it very easy. That's why I work with Sheila Tumilty at our HIV care center at the Miriam Hospital under Dr. Timothy Flanagan, and we eliminate hep C among our 500 patients there. And that's why we are so fortunate to have Dr. Poshkas, and we want to focus on corrections. We want to give a shout out to our incredible VA. The Veterans Administration is the largest provider of hep C care in the United States. And we have an incredible VA program headed by Dr. Pramrat, Dr. Lally, Dr. Gaitanis. We want to eliminate hep C in our VA. And hey, there's a bipartisan issue if you've ever heard of one. Get more money to cure the veterans. That's something everybody can agree upon. So we want to focus on the places where we have a lot of people concentrated with hep C in the shortest amount of time, cure as many people at that locale as possible. The idea of navigating people through hundreds of steps is based on the HIV care model, which is based on having federal funding. There's no federal hep C support.
We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But also, briefly, I know one of your goals is to get more people screened, because you can't treat someone unless you know their status, right? So for people who haven't been steeped in this like you are, why hasn't this been such a priority? Why isn't it just part of a regular doctor's office visit to get screened for hepatitis C?
So many reasons, and I think Dr. Sipi spoke to some of this. First of all, hep C is a silent illness. If we all injected me right now with hep C, I'd probably feel nothing. So we have no idea when we've acquired hep C. We feel nothing. When people say, I turned yellow, I went to the emergency room, that wasn't hep C, that was hepatitis B. So we don't feel anything, we catch it, we won't know that we have it unless we get a test. And how many physicians in this room learned about hep C in med school? I think we got 1 minute in medical school. It wasn't an issue, it was a very unpopular disease. It was thought to be unimportant, it was thought to be not curable. It was thought to occur among people who were less important, which of course is egregious, even to speak those words out loud. And so it's really now that we have this crisis with this wave of the baby boomers aging that the CDC and others are starting to realize that we have terrible years ahead if we don't intervene immediately. We have been in the next 1, 3, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to be taking people out with tremendous suffering at the prime of their lives. And so all of this is coming together with the World Health Organization and the CDC, and we now have simple testing that we can do. And here's the key. Automatic reminders through an electronic medical record. All of you tech-savvy people know a lot more about this than I do, but what we have are electronic medical records. We should be the first state in the country to cover our entire state medical community with an electronic medical record prompt to say, hey, baby boomers, get screened for hepatitis C. You don't remember what you did in 1960. Maybe you snorted cocaine once. It doesn't even matter. It just matters if you were around and a teenager or in your 20s or 30s, get tested. Most people say, how did I get this? I don't even know. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very appreciative of Lifespan, the largest health provider in the state. On April 1st, when they go live with their new electronic medical record system, we're going to be having pop-up reminders to screen baby boomers, and we really need the whole state to be doing this.
Great. You're listening to Hepatitis C, Cost, Cure, and Challenge on Rhode Island Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from Brown University. I'm your host, Kristen Gourlay. We're talking with Dr. Lynn Taylor here, and I want to bring Dr. Amy Nunn into the conversation. She heads the Rhode Island Public Health Institute. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you.
So you may have heard before that Lynn Taylor and other doctors like her are having a tough time getting these the new medications, the new treatments for hepatitis C that are out there. They're having a tough time getting them for their patients. And it's heartbreaking to have to tell a patient to wait. I've spoken with Lynn Taylor about this many times before. But insurers and public payers like Medicaid are in a tough position, right? They can't afford these drugs for everyone who needs them right now. Rhode Island's Medicaid program is already in the red, primarily because of hepatitis C treatments. So something has got to give. What is it?
Well, I think we're going to have to spend more on this public health crisis. That's the bottom line. But I think we also need to think about how we can shift the business model. Currently, we're working within the confines of a high margin, low volume model. What does that mean? That means that the drugs are very expensive and we're providing them to very few people. With those same amount of resources, if we were to move to a low margin, high volume model, we could cure a lot more people. How does that happen? Social progress over time. This is not a problem that's going to go away. But we have lessons from history. We know that this worked for AIDS treatment. I want to remind everyone, in 2000, our government's policy was that we were not going to spend monies on antiretroviral drugs to treat people in Africa. Our policy was that we were going to let those people die because it was not cost effective. What happened? George Bush introduced the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and we started scaling up treatment to millions of people across the developing world. Now about 10 million people in developing countries are on AIDS treatment. We went from a high margin, low volume model to a high volume, low margin model by working with the private sector to develop innovative strategies. We also decided we were going to spend money on this issue. Back then, we said that it was too expensive to treat people because it cost $10,000 per patient per year to treat people living with AIDS. And it was a human rights crisis to say it was too expensive. Well, activists held us accountable, and they also worked with governments to try to develop innovative strategies. And as a result, the cost of AIDS treatment in developing countries now is less than $100 per patient per year because government and industry got together in the same room and figured out how to work out this problem. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to do that with this disease. There's no way around it.
But the easiest solution, right, is just lower the drug prices. These are very cheap drugs to manufacture. What are they paying, $1 a day in Egypt? $100 a day in countries with universal health care. We in the United States are bearing the cost of drug development, and the prices are the highest here. Why? Because it's a free-for-all and a business model, and there's no regulation and no pressure. We're here to pressure the drug companies. We wouldn't be here if the prices went down, which they could. That's the first step. Lower the drug prices. You'll garner more support for treatment, and we'll treat more people, and you'll still make the same profits. It's not Medicaid's fault.
Right. There are so many parallels, I think, between HIV and AIDS and hepatitis C. Could we just explore this a little bit more? Amy Nunn, you know, there was a time when we didn't know the extent of the HIV epidemic. We didn't know, you know, people couldn't get treatment. It took a social movement. What are some of the parallels? What are some of the differences in this particular case?
I think the biggest difference with the social movements is that this was something that impacted affluent white men. And also we had drugs to treat people. that they demanded be developed by both our government and our industry, and a social movement is lacking. So the reason that we wanted to put this event together was to help garner support among the millions of baby boomers across the country and the thousands of people in Rhode Island that have hepatitis C and may not even know it, or may not know that they can take one pill once a day and get cured, to really pressure our government and the pharmaceutical industry to do something about this crisis. One of the things that we have to do to move that business model and to change it is to increase screening, because a lot of people don't know that they're infected. If we increase the number of people who know their status, then we can change that business model. But it all really starts with prevention and with screening. And I agree with what Dr. Taylor said about increasing screening and routine during the course of routine clinical care. That's an easy and inexpensive way to screen people to scale. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we're working really hard together on to see if we can move this needle in Rhode Island.
There's another funding issue that you raise, though. I mean, there's the cost of the new drugs to treat hepatitis C, no doubt. But there's also the cost of prevention, education, screening, and there's such a huge disparity between the funding for HIV and AIDS prevention and screening and money available from federal and state sources for hepatitis C prevention, screening, education. Your thoughts?
I think that's one reason is because we don't have a social movement. Perhaps one reason we haven't had a social movement around this is because there haven't been great treatment options available. So now that there are treatment options available, I think that we really need to rally support around that. The other thing is we may need a Ryan White lookalike program. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know what the Ryan White program is, it's a payer of last resort to pay for treatment, care, and medications for people living with HIV. The magnitude of this problem is so much bigger, I would posit that this may require a federal solution. We may need a Ryan White lookalike program for hepatitis C, and it's something that a lot of us are getting involved in the advocacy world, and Dr. Taylor in particular has been really vocal about this. And I think it's something that we really ought to put on the table, both at the federal level and at the state level. The alternative is that all of these people, I want to remind everyone, are going to age into Medicare. So it's pay now or pay later. And the longer we wait, the more expensive it's going to be. And the taxpayer is going to have to foot the bill in either case. So I would argue that it's cheaper to pay people now and work on changing this business model so that we can really attack this now while it's cheaper.
So we need a plan to do that, and I want to talk a little bit about some of your work, both of you. You've started, you're heading up the, Amy Nunn, the statewide Hepatitis C Action Coalition. So this is a group of people from all across the state in different fields who've come together. Dr. Taylor is a part of this, and you are developing a state plan right now, or embarking on this project to fight hepatitis C. Lynn Taylor, what should be in the plan?
And we only
First
have
of
a few
all,
minutes.
A focus, a commitment to keeping Hep C front and center in Rhode Island, and a commitment to moving fast, and a commitment to working to make sure that the existing healthcare disparities that exist are not sharpened by the epidemic and deciding there are haves and have-nots, and focusing on the crisis among the patients, the older patients with the more advanced disease, who we could prevent this, again, this impending disaster of premature death. I also think that's what's very important right now is that we include a focus on Medicaid. And yes, Medicaid is in a very tough situation. They only have a certain budget they have. But I'm concerned that the current Medicaid situation in terms of the Hep C medications is not only discriminatory and disrespectful, but it's illegal. And I'm not a lawyer, but I'm working with lawyers, and I think we should have another forum and bring some lawyers in to address the issue of whether Medicaid in Rhode Island or any other state is allowed to take drugs that are approved by the FDA for people with chronic hepatitis C of all stages and say we're only going to use it for people with this stage. Or even to question about substance use in any way. There should be no reference to alcohol use, injection drug use, prior drug use. It's not medically relevant in terms of Medicaid policy. So we have to have a focus on having a transparent, open process open to the public, easily accessible, that Rhode Islanders can weigh in on. That's a living document that moves quickly over time.
And Dr. Taylor's talking about the questions that are asked on a pre-authorization form. That's what insurance companies use to determine whether or not you'll get approved for a drug. And one of those has to do with your current substance abuse status. Amy Nunn, what should be in the plan?
Bulk purchase agreements. I think we need to negotiate with drug companies much cheaper prices, and we can do that by committing to treat certain numbers of people. This is not just a solution in Rhode Island. The VA does it. If the VA is doing it now, why can't we do this across the nation? I think that Medicaid plans across the country can and should, and my understanding is they are trying to engage in bulk purchase agreements so that there is an agreement in place that would allow drug companies to dramatically reduce their prices in exchange for committing to large purchases. There was today, it was announced that the AIDS Drug Assistance Program engaged in a huge bulk purchase with AbbVie Pharmaceuticals. I think this is a great model, and it's something we can learn a lot from, and I think it's something that we should take to scale with the other drug companies, because increasingly more products are going to be released to the marketplace, and we can only create a virtuous public health cycle if we start screening and treating people. If we just wait and we fight about the prices indefinitely, then people aren't going to get cured. We've got to have some really tough conversations between government and industry, and we need to get advocates involved in this too, and to shine a bright light on this as a crisis. It can't be just a beating up on Medicaid about their refusal to treat, and it can't be just beating up pharmaceutical companies about their high prices. They've got to come together and agree that we can do this better.
And we are going to have to leave it there. There's so much more to talk about, but that's all the time we have right now. I want to thank Dr. Lynn Taylor, Dr. Amy Nunn for being here. That is it for this special hour, this special forum on hepatitis C on Rhode Island Public Radio. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. And thank you to our live audience here. I want to thank all of our guests for being here tonight. And a very big thank you to everyone at the Rhode Island Public Health Institute, the Brown School of Public Health, and Brown University for making this event happen, especially our technical folks in the back. Thanks also to our engineer, Aaron Reed, and our news director, Catherine Welch. Rhode Island Public Radio's reporting on hepatitis C was supported by the Annenberg School and the Rhode Island Foundation. Thanks very much. I'm Kristen Gourlay.
Good job, Aaron.